Hi, I am David Newell, and you may know me better as Mr. McFeely, the speedy delivery man from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. For the listeners, Mr. McFeely is a character who is sort of in his 60s, 70s, 50s, somewhere. But when I created the character, Fred said, you know what I want to do is I want to make you elderly, but not too old, because I want to do flashbacks where we appeared as our younger, I appeared, and Mrs. McFeely appeared as our younger selves, and we did flashbacks that showed what it was like when we first were married and so forth, which in turn gave us a chance to let children see, you know how you sometimes think of what your parents might have looked like when they were in their 20s, and I think that was part of Fred's plan, at any rate. So I planned the character that I'd have a mustache and somewhat gray hair and a little sort of, what, granny glasses, sort of. They're sort of granny or now the ones you see in that picture there. I have a picture on the desk here as we're talking about the program. And the glasses are now prescription. Before, when I first started, they weren't prescription.
That happens to all of us.
Oh, yes. Yes, it does. But because I couldn't, I found I couldn't read the script after a while. And so anyhow, this is our 50th anniversary. 2018 is our 50 years on the air of producing Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So we're celebrating.
And so are you basically on tour?
Yes and no. There is a hospital here in Layton Hospital, yes. And they're having an opening of a new hospital in their complex. And their theme is neighbors and neighborhood. And they thought, well, why don't we contact Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and see if we can get somebody to come out and help celebrate with us. And so here I am, Mr. McFeely, because I'm one of the neighbors that has been on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood since day one. So there's going to be a screening of the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, which maybe you have seen. And it's in theaters now, but it's being released also on DVD, Blu-ray, and I think it's being streamed, and it's expanding, and the legacy carries on of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So back to your Am I On Tour? In a way, I am, because I've been going to different theaters hosting the screening and associated with different public television stations that have the event, and they have the screening, and it helps promote public television and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and celebrates our 50th. So yes and no, I'm sort of on a little tour, a mini tour.
Why is it important to support public broadcasting?
I love public broadcasting. And if it were not for public broadcasting, I wonder if Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood would have lasted this long. Because we started in 1967 with the present series. That's when we started to tape. It went on the air in February 19th, 1968, to be exact. And you know, PBS, public broadcasting, gave us a chance to grow. You know, if nothing against commercial television, but you know, we would have been canceled probably after the first or second year. But here we are, 50 years later, and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood is still available in some way on public broadcasting, or it's on being streamed. And I love public radio. Fred Rogers loved public radio. There's a station in Pittsburgh where we taped our show, WQED television, but it has an FM station. He loved that. He had it on his radio all the time in his car. He didn't like noise, and he didn't like, in fact, one time he bought a car, he had the radio taken out because he was too... But he kept it in. I said, Fred, you can listen to public radio. And he kept it in, and he loved public radio. He really did. He was also a musician, and his background is in music, his composition. His wife is a concert pianist. So they're very much public radio and television supporters. And I think it's important to support it because what I just said earlier, it gives you, they give you a chance to evolve. They gave us that chance to evolve. But it's also, who's going to play Beethoven for 2 hours or whatever? Who's going to interview obscure authors, but good authors? Who's going to do cut-ins to Morning Edition, as you do? Not too many people, but public radio does it. And that's what we should be doing with public radio, I think. I think that the more local, the better, in my opinion. Of course, now it costs money, so that's why we have pledge drives. So I hope your listeners who are listening to this will consider public radio and television for their next little pledge and make it a speedy delivery.
So tell me how it was that you came up with the catchphrase speedy delivery.
Well, I was interviewed by Fred Rogers for the position. Not just Mr. McFeely, but the position that I had to begin with all these many years was I was in charge of all the props and costumes. I was a production coordinator. That was my initial job. And I was hired for that. And during the interview, 50 years ago, Fred hired me. But he said, oh, before you leave, I want you to play a part on the program because I know you had theater experience, and so I'm writing in a delivery man, and I want you to play it. And I said, fine, I'd love to do that. And he said, your name will be Mr. McCurdy. That's the name, McCurdy. Well, talking about underwriting, Sears Roebuck's Foundation gave us underwriting money for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood to do the initial outlay, and also for the next 25 years, they helped us. Thank you, Sears Roebuck. And to make a long story short, just before we were ready to tape the first program, the phone rang, and it was Sears calling and saying, we want to wish you well on your first day of taping, and we like your concept, and everything about your program. But they said, please don't call the delivery man Mr. McCurdy, because that was the name of the president of the Sears Roebuck Foundation who gave us the money. But Fred was saying simply thank you, because he wrote his own material. He was just saying thank you by putting that name in. He said, okay, well, we'll find another name. So he came back into the studio. We were ready to tape in 10 minutes. And he said, we have to get you another name. And before he finished that sentence, practically, he said, McFeely, that's your name, Mr. McFeely. That's his middle name. And so now I'm Mr. McFeely. So we went on to tape the first sequence I was in, and my badge on my jacket says Speedy Delivery. That was the name of my company, my one-person company. So I brought the delivery, and we chatted about whatever I brought in. It was an armadillo. That's what it was. An armadillo to show the children. And I said, well, I have to take it back to the zoo, Mr. Rogers. I'll see you around the neighborhood. Speedy delivery to you. And it stuck, and Mr. Rogers said, well, speedy delivery, Mr. McFeely. And off I went, and it's become my catchphrase ever since that first day. So here I am. And sometimes they don't call me McFeely. They call me Speedy or Speedy Gonzalez. I get all of that. So that's how Speedy Delivery began. And in fact, there's even a documentary on me called Speedy Delivery that tells my career with the neighborhood from my point of view. And I'd like to write a book, too, about my 50 years working with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and the production company, about my adventures and who I met, and a little poignant story and a happy story and a funny story about all the different people I've met over all these years, and the children and the families and the feedback you get. I just spent the weekend in Philadelphia at a Philadelphia Comic Con. And it runs the gamut from artists to superheroes to nostalgia. But I was there with Big Bird and Kermit the Frog, the man who plays Kermit the Frog. And we sat together. And the stories you hear about what these programs have meant on public television to families. And since we started in 1968, the people who are now in their 50s who grew up. That first wave of kids are in their 50s. And you get all of these wonderful stories. You were one of the first wave. And down to high school kids that are coming. And now it's on Amazon.com. You can see it any time of day or night, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And so we're getting different feedback from different families and younger children now who are catching it because they are able to access it online. It has been a wonderful, wonderful 50 years working with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood Company. Our company is now called Fred Rogers Productions. And for your listeners, they may know about it. There's a legacy of another program called Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. It's animated. It's on public television daily. It's one of the most watched programs on public television for children, for children's programs. And it's now in 24 countries. So the legacy started in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, off public television. In 1954, Fred Rogers had a program called The Children's Corner. That went on the air locally in Pittsburgh and ran for 7 years. And then he took that program and or elements of it and moved to Canada on the CBC, and that's where Mr. Rogers started. And he came back to the States and he started. That's when Sears got into the picture. They heard about this program that was so successful in Canada, and they invited him to bring it to public television, or public, somehow it got to public television with the help of the Sears Foundation. And that's when I started in 1967. And I thought, I have a job for 1 year, and here I am. And it just grew and grew and grew, and I stayed and stayed and stayed. And we made over 1,000 programs, and they're all now available online somewhere to be seen.
So you mentioned an armadillo was your first yes. speedy delivery. What was the most unusual speedy delivery that you ever made?
Oh, boy, there were a lot of them. An elephant was one, a baby elephant. But I think it's not unusual necessarily, but it was my most favorite delivery, which was the Wicked Witch of the West. You know, Margaret Hamilton from The Wizard of Oz. Well, I heard a lot of stories during the many years, because, you know, Wizard of Oz was on television a lot, and it would scare kids, you know, the monkeys and the witch. And adults would tell me, they said, I can't watch that, it terrified me as a child. And I said, Fred, you know, I've heard these many stories of adults telling me how that witch and the monkeys and all that scary stuff scared them. They had nightmares. We should do something about it. Let's maybe talk about pretend, the things that aren't real, and pretending and acting and so forth. Fred said, if you can locate Margaret Hamilton, the Wicked Witch, she was still a working actress, I'll write the script. And I located her. She was touring in a musical called Little Night Music, playing the mother of the lead in the music, and her grandchildren just by chance watched the program, and she watched with them and loved the program, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So she said, sure. And because she also got the same stories, that how much her character frightened, and she came on dressed in her civilian clothes and talked about her character, and we had a costume like the one that she wore in the movie. She said, that's my job. I'm an actress. And see, I'm not a scary person. It's pretend. And she said, I dressed up. It's like Halloween. And she demystified the scary parts of it. And I think that was my favorite delivery, because I brought her. I knocked on the door and said, speedy delivery. And Margaret was trailing, and I introduced her to Fred. And then they carried on with the scene. So I think that was my favorite, and probably the most unusual.
Can you describe, for those who are not familiar with what the neighborhood looked like, and still does if you watch the shows today, describe that neighborhood, and then let's talk a little bit about how neighborhoods maybe are different or the same as they were at that time, and the way you and Fred had hoped to depict neighborhoods.
The neighborhood, as Fred created it on television, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, was sort of a symbol for friendship, in a way. But he grew up in a small Pennsylvania town, it's called Latrobe, Pennsylvania, that looked a lot like the neighborhood that he created on television. It had a bakery and a music store and so forth, and he duplicated all those. And it had a trolley then that ran through town, trolley tracks that went through the town. And his growing up was very comfortable, I think. And his family was very prominent and they were very, very helpful to people who didn't have much. And I think Fred learned from his to give back and to be kind. And he took all of that and sort of put it into a neighborhood which stood for a much bigger world, I think.
Yeah, I always felt like it was a safe place.
It is a safe place, but also a place where you can talk about anything, too. In safe places, I think you can talk about things that might be bothering you and encourage children to talk about things that might be scary, to talk about if you have angry feelings. There's nothing wrong with being angry. It's what you do with that anger. You don't hit somebody. You talk it out. And I think within that neighborhood that he created, it was almost it was a symbol for so much kindness and variety of every, just a corny phrase, but a melting pot. Everybody lived in that neighborhood, and everybody got along, basically. Sometimes there were disagreements. It wasn't nirvana, but he had days that maybe somebody was sad or angry and used maybe one of the puppets. Daniel Tiger, for instance, was afraid of going to school for the first time. And of course, there was a school in this neighborhood. And Daniel was very frightened, and he was worried that he didn't know his numbers and letters when he went to school. And throughout the course of the neighborhood of make-believe scene, that's what they talked about. Daniel, that's why you're going to school. You don't have to know numbers and letters. You'll learn them in school, and you'll learn, and you'll meet a lot of different people. You'll make some friends, etc. So that was a week about going to school that he dealt with.
Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, for me, was a very comforting time, almost represented what I would want in a community when I grew up. To be able to have a bakery next door. I was introduced to different instruments through the music store.
Van Cliburn was one of the first guests we had on the program. We had Isaac Perlman, and we had Yo-Yo Ma, which was one of the highlights. Fred and Yo-Yo became very good friends, and he was on three times. So many different musicians. We would go to places to show children how things are made. Crayons, shoes, sneakers, tofu, how crayons are made, how such and such is made. But Fred stopped. This is how subtle he was at times. He said, you know, I'm going to start calling them how people make crayons, how people make shoes, how people make whatever it is. Because he wanted children to know that these don't magically get made by themselves. The machines don't magically make them. It takes a person to invent the machine and to operate the machines. So that was Fred. He was very, very subtle in his approach. And he would update things all the time, just like that little bit of a change. It does make a big difference, don't you think? How people make crayons is different than how crayons are made.
Was there a segment about the making of how people made marbles?
Yes. Yes. Why? Did you see that?
I remember that. As you were talking, I'm like, I remember the marbles going down kind of like a maze.
Yes, there was that. There was, the one that I loved was how fortune cookies are made. how people made fortune cookies. And I've often wondered, how do they get the fortune inside of there? Well, you see it when you go through the process. And we made about 300 of those little films over the years. But right now, in Pittsburgh, Tom Hanks is making a film based on the life of Fred Rogers, and Tom Hanks is playing Fred Rogers. It'll be out about a year from now. So the legacy still continues, and this year has been quite the year of Fred, I think. His background is in theology, music, and child development, and all of those disciplines he put together and created Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and he uses it to tell stories and talk to children about important things.
Public broadcasting kind of, that became the niche, to be able to help educate as well as entertain.
Yes, and I mean, you hear that all the time on pledge drives, but it's true when you think of it. The reason they called it public broadcasting after a while is they called it educational television, and they were afraid, oh, people won't watch if they're going to be educated. Let's call it something that's not. Now they're going back to it because that is the important. It's, education isn't necessarily a bad word, but I think people think of it as a little dry. But it's not. Public television and public radio, it's very entertaining, I think. Oh, and by the way, and maybe a public radio can find them in their archives. In the mid-70s, there was a Mr. Rogers Neighborhood on Saturday mornings. It was an hour show, and we tried it for about a month or two. And we did a neighborhood of make-believe, and there was a little story. Fred, in fact, went to D.C. to record his part of it. We did the neighborhood in Pittsburgh, and it was live to tape, I guess. But it was a Mr. Rogers Neighborhood on radio. I don't know whatever's happened to those tapes, but I remember being on it. I was in the segment with the neighborhood of make-believe as McFeely, and the first guest was Van Cliburn on the public radio. So anyhow.
And they probably used a lot of sound effects and a lot of, you know, to help set the scene. I love that about radio, the use of sound to create an image.
And that's what Fred always wanted to do. I think after the neighborhood stopped taping, what he would have loved to have done was he wanted a public radio interview show. He wanted to talk to people without any kind of interruption.
So I want to kind of come back to this whole neighborhood concept. Do you feel like what Fred Rogers was trying to accomplish through Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, this safe zone, this way of communicating, sharing thoughts, ideas, helping determine reality from fantasy, is that still something we need to be taught today?
Oh, I think it is. Oh, my, yes. And I don't think it is. And in fact, after Won't You Be My Neighbor, the documentary was shown, in every review that I read and every letter to the editor, it always said, this is the kind of program we need more of. Where is Mr. Rogers when you need him? I don't think we have enough examples of that. And I think this is how Fred used television. There's a Mormon saying, I believe it's Mormon, attitudes are caught, not taught. If you love doing something in front of children, they'll catch it. And Fred did love doing what he did. In fact, I'll give you another example. When he was studying his child development, classes, he was assigned to go to a daycare center at the University of Pittsburgh where he was studying. And that daycare center, each week they had a parent come in and show what that parent does for a living, a baker, a car repairman, whatever. One parent came in. It was a man who was a sculptor, and he brought in a chunk of clay, and he didn't say a thing. The children were sitting all around the table. He plopped the clay down and started to sculpt something. And the teacher said that the rest of that year, that class, their artwork just was so much more sophisticated and more imaginative. But they could see that sculpture, the children could see how much he loved doing what he was doing. And they caught his enthusiasm. So if you love doing something, they'll catch it. And I think that's what Fred did. And I think that is success of the program, too. And in fact, I think we all loved what we were doing. I wouldn't be there 50 years if I didn't love what I was doing. And it's a corny saying, but you probably heard of it. When you choose your career, make sure it's something you love, because you'll never work a day in your life. You've heard that. And I think I've never worked a day in my life. But I think children catch that. And I think that was Fred's way of teaching, by showing something that he loved.
One thing I reflect back on, there was purpose in everything he did. There was a reason why he took his shoes off, his work shoes, from coming outside, coming to the inside, replacing those, feeding the fish, you know, showing us the example of being responsible for our pets and others that we're in the care of, or that we care for. Purpose in everything he did.
Yes, nothing was by chance. Fred was driven in a good way. And everybody who works with our company has some background in children. In some way, I had a background in children's theater, but I feel I have a master's degree after working with Fred all those years in child development. I learned so much, and it's almost osmosis. You know, you learn it that way.
I think that testifies to how we spend our time and who we spend our time with, but also the power and the influence of media.
Oh, what it can, I don't think we realize the power of media. Sesame Street over the years can teach numbers and letters, and what can the negative material they see on television do? This is children and to adults. You know, it's got to have some effect. And that's why Fred said, he called the distance between the television screen and the person on television, that space between the two, holy ground. And producers have a responsibility to create the best program they can for any age, especially for children. And Fred went out of his way, as we talked about it earlier, to separate that fantasy and reality. That's why the program's set up the way it is. He comes in, and you mentioned a little earlier, he comes into his television house, puts on play clothes, the sneakers or the sweater, symbol for play clothes, talks about, maybe sets up the day's topic. Then the neighborhood of make-believe, the trolley is the transition object into pretend, where anything can happen, and we talk about it there a little bit, and then the trolley brings it back to reality. He was a wonderful pianist. He never thought he was, but he composed all the music, and he did most of the lyrics. He wrote all of his programs, for the most part. There were a few writers that helped him, but Fred oversaw everything. He had the last call on camera shots. People would say, I've heard that his mother made his sweaters, and that's true. His mother was a knitter, and every Christmas she'd start January 1st knitting sweaters for him, his sister and cousins and so forth. So Fred always knew one present he was getting for Christmas was a sweater. And he saved a lot of them. He used them on the neighborhood. And one of them is in the Smithsonian.
I have seen. It's the red sweater that's in the Smithsonian. I was surprised at the size of the sweater. He wasn't a heavy set man, but he was. His shoulders were nice and strong.
143 is Fred's weight. He kept it at 143 the whole time. Those numbers, I think, in Morse code or in some configuration, mean I love you. Nothing that you saw on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was ever by chance. It was well thought out. In fact, one of the most requested programs or topics that we had was on divorce. And that came through our fan mail. we would get letters saying, Mr. Rogers, do you think that you could address divorce for our family, for the children, to see if you can interpret it so a child might understand? And it took him 5 years to really get it the way he wanted it, to get the scripts right. But he did. That was the most requested topic we've ever had. And it was very helpful. But the one thing that came out of all of that was, for children, that no matter what happened in your family divorce, it was not the child's fault. And that's the one thing he wanted children to realize. And it was synthesized down to that.
Did he ever show his emotions as far as having to talk about topics that maybe were uncomfortable, or realizing that children were going through things that were hurtful, misunderstood, or maybe confusing to them?
Well, we did a program on death, and his father died, I think, early on in our, maybe it was the second year of taping, and it was had a profound effect on Fred. He was quite close to his father. But he took that emotion and that concern and put it into a script form, and he had a goldfish die in the tank. And he likened that to talking about it. He took it out and buried it, and then talked about how sad he felt when his dog died, Mitzi died. And that was very helpful. Then, not far after that, in 1968, I remember waking up the morning of the Bobby Kennedy assassination. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, and right on the radio comes another disaster. You know, it was Kennedy, King Kennedy. And Fred, I got into the studio, and whatever we were planning that day was off. And Fred and his mentor, Dr. Margaret McFarlane, were conferring, and they wrote a script. I mean, she advised, but Fred wrote it on the word assassination and what that meant. Children were hearing it because King was months before that. And that was, when you think about it, that was a very, very tumultuous time. You know, Vietnam War, and all of that was happening. And Fred tried to address some of that. But he really thought, okay, we have to deal with this. Children, we can't let this go. And he did. Shows somebody who really cared about children and did something about it. Fred was the real thing. People always ask his wife, what's Fred like at home? Does he throw a sneaker across the... and she said, what you see is what you get. And oh, also, you know, as you know, making radio and television programs, they can be stressful at times. You know, something happens, and the power goes off, or something happens. And that would happen in our tapings. Somebody would forget a line, the camera would lose a color bar or something, and we'd have to wait. And Fred was frustrated, you know, but he wouldn't get angry and yell. He never did that, but he would go over to the piano and sit down and start playing the piano very deliberately. And you could tell that he was frustrated and somewhat angry. And he always said that his anger came out through his fingers. And it's exactly what he was telling children to do. You know, don't hit somebody if you're angry. You can go over and bang on a drum, bang on a piano. That's much better than hitting somebody.
But he acknowledged that it's okay to be angry.
Yes, there's nothing wrong with being angry. That's a human emotion. And, you know, we dealt with jealousy and sibling rivalry. That is a human emotion. But he talked about it. It's good to talk about things. And that's what I think I learned being on the program and working with Fred Rogers, that, you know, it's okay to talk about things that might be upsetting and things that you might not want to talk about. You know, no one's perfect.